From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
This is Josh Barrow, and you're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. I am joined, as always, by Ken White for our weekly exploration of Donald Trump's sprawling legal issues. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com, and he hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Josh.
Today, we're going to talk about emoluments. I know that's your favorite.
Oh, yeah. It's why I went to law school, really.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about the FBI background investigation into Brett Kavanaugh and how the White House has been overseeing that. We're going to talk about all of these perjury allegations swirling around. But first, Stormy Daniels. We learned this week from the Wall Street Journal that Donald Trump personally instructed Michael Cohen to seek to enforce the hush agreement against Daniels, using his son Eric as a go-between. Ken, in retrospect, this was a poor choice.
It was a terrible choice, but you're right. We're captured by history knowing how it turned out.
It was a poor choice because it basically set off all of the dominoes, or appears to have set off the dominoes, of legal investigation to Michael Cohen that have led to his guilty plea and to his potential cooperation with the government, although he doesn't have a formal cooperation agreement in the way Paul Manafort does.
Correct. And I think this is an example of the president not completely grasping how he's in a different world than he was in the private sector, not completely grasping that the sort of legal threats and enforcement of contracts and hush money agreements that he could get away with in the past are now going to lead to much more publicity and scrutiny rather than successfully silencing people.
Well, and I think the other thing is he has this history of using lawsuits as a weapon, basically, even if he's not going to win, being so annoying and such a pain and so litigious that people just give up and give him what he wants. But it seems to be different when you're president. A lawsuit is a lot more painful to you than it might be if you were just a private citizen. But does this revelation have legal significance? Obviously, it was a dumb thing Trump did. It means he's been lying about his involvement with the hush agreement. Does it actually affect any of the litigation that we know that he instructed Cohen to go enforce this thing?
No, not as so far. So there hasn't, I believe, been any suggestion that there's any obstruction of justice involved. And actually, you know, trying to enforce through the legal system a contract, even if people think it's a bogus contract, is not obstruction of justice, just bad judgment.
Okay, so we can move on then. Ken, can you tell our audience who Lawrence Tribe is?
Lawrence Tribe is a professor at Harvard Law School, long one of the leading legal thinkers in the country, frequent Supreme Court advocate and maker of legal opinions on the liberal side for decades, until recently.
So until recently, I think it's useful to think of Lawrence Tribe and Alan Dershowitz as sort of two sides of the same coin, these very highly respected professors at Harvard Law School who both seem to have been driven a little bit insane by the Trump administration, but in opposite directions. You have Dershowitz running around trying to find all of the trolley available defenses of the president, and then you have Lawrence Tribe sort of off on the deepest end of resistance Twitter with fairly dubious legal thinking that is below the standard you would normally expect from Lawrence Tribe pre-2016.
Absolutely. Twitter has brought out Lawrence Tribe as sort of the hot take artist.
So here's something that he tweeted this week. He says, quote, "Here's a thought. Presidential limits on the scope of FBI investigation, if calculated to protect Kavanaugh's possible perjury from inquiry and thus ensure his place on the Supreme Court to shield POTUS from subpoena and indictment, might be corrupt obstruction of justice." So there's a number of parts of that. We're actually going to pick this tweet apart piece by piece for about 25 minutes, so I hope you're excited for that, Ken.
Thrilled.
Overall, does that sound right to you?
No, not even close. It's something you hear as a theory on Reddit, not something you expect to hear from one of the best-known constitutional professors in the country.
So normally, it's not that I want to spend a whole show on a bad tweet, but actually, even though the tweet itself is not a good tweet, there are a number of components of it that give us a roadmap to discuss a number of key news stories this week. I see four key claims here from Professor Tribe. One, he's complaining about presidential limits on the scope of the FBI investigation. This has been the subject of a lot of news, the White House telling the FBI what it may and may not ask of whom about Brett Kavanaugh. The second is Kavanaugh's possible perjury. Professor Tribe is concerned that Kavanaugh may have lied before Congress. A lot of other people are concerned about that. The third item is the concern that Kavanaugh might shield the president from subpoena and indictment. If he sits on the Supreme Court, obviously he couldn't do that alone, but there are a number of things that might get before the nine justices. And there are some non-crazy concerns about this, even if this tweet isn't putting this in a good way. And the fourth is the claim that all of this could be corrupt obstruction of justice. So I want to start with that last one. The president ordered this FBI investigation himself. He did it at the request of Congress, but it's his prerogative to ask the FBI to conduct this background investigation. I'm trying to think about how to even think about this in this frame. How, if the president called for this investigation, it's not even a criminal investigation, it's a background investigation. How could he possibly obstruct justice in any way by limiting its scope?
Yeah, it's very improbable. And let's remember the context here. So after a very brutal and controversial week of hearings regarding nominee Judge Kavanaugh, a sort of deal was struck where the vote would be put off for a week if there would be some sort of FBI investigation of some of the allegations of sexual misconduct. The president backed that up by telling the FBI to investigate, but then stories circulated that he was limiting the scope of that investigation. And I'd say there's conflicting stories about that limitation. So Professor Tribe's theory seems to be, well, he's restricting the investigation so Kavanaugh will get confirmed, so that Kavanaugh will then vote the way he wants to on things, and then that will protect him when people are trying to hold him accountable for bad things he's done. It's very remote, it's very abstract, and the core problem with it is that obstruction of justice has to be corruptly interfering with the due administration of justice. And the presidential act of appointing somebody, which is a core presidential power, just because you don't like the way that person's going to vote or you might disagree with it, can't possibly be the interference with a due administration of justice.
So let's go back to that first point then. You know, even if it's not a crime, there's this question of whether the president is in one way or another improperly limiting this FBI background investigation. And you say there were conflicting reports. I think there was also a changing situation through the course of the week, that the White House counsel's office had communicated to the FBI certain restrictions. This drew a lot of objection from Democrats and, more importantly, objection from some key Republicans in the Senate who wanted this investigation in the first place. And so you got a new directive from the White House that is supposed to give the FBI more free rein. But they're still under this time deadline that they have to produce the background investigation by Friday. And so I guess when you think about, you give the FBI this job and you impose some unspecified limits on scope, and you maybe more importantly impose this limit on time, how does that change the efficacy of a background investigation the FBI might try to conduct?
It completely prevents the sort of investigation that the FBI is good at. It makes it a gesture and not a serious investigation. The competitive advantage of federal agencies and federal prosecutors and those types of entities is the sort of thing we've been seeing in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, a long-term, methodical, step-by-step, move from one witness to another witness type of maneuver. And the FBI is good at that, but it takes a lot of time. And there's no way that you can do serious investigation, let alone of things that happened 35 years ago, over the course of a week. It just doesn't happen. So it really marks it as almost purely a gesture so that they can use it to persuade persuadable wavering Republicans to go ahead and vote for Kavanaugh.
Although one interesting thing is we are hearing that the FBI is starting to talk to some witnesses beyond the initial list of four that they were supposed to speak with. And there are these reports that the FBI investigators seem to be focusing on the July 1 entry in Brett Kavanaugh's 1982 summer calendar, which indicates that he was getting skis, which is brewskis, beers, with people including PJ and Squee. And Judge, this is a party whose description could conceivably match Dr. Ford's description of a small gathering where she says she was assaulted.
And they're developing some information about that. But the question is, what are they going to develop that is going to be actionable for anyone who's voting on this? Because we have to keep coming back to the idea that this is a purely political process. The committee votes how they want to vote. The Senate votes how they want to vote. There is no process dictated by law other than that the Senate gets to advise and consent. So it's not any sort of magic number of witnesses you have to get to. There's no set standard of clear and convincing evidence or preponderance of the evidence. It's purely politically, how are people going to vote? So, you know, it's really a matter of, does this persuade the persuadable? Does it become something that, if leaked to the press or released to the press, is enough to move public interest in this and public opposition to Kavanaugh?
Neera Tanden, who's the president of the Center for American Progress, which is a left-of-center think tank, she was the head of policy for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. She tweeted about the FBI's apparent interview of Mark Judge, who Dr. Ford says was the witness to the assault that she alleges that Brett Kavanaugh committed. Tanden tweets, quote, "Mark Judge testified for hours. It doesn't take hours to say I don't remember." Does that sound right to you?
No, that's silly. The FBI, when they're doing a good job, will interview people extremely thoroughly for a long period of time. They will ask you 200 questions, even if you're saying, I don't remember each and every one. They will ask you the same questions over and over again, trying to get you to give a different answer. They'll use all the techniques that law enforcement uses to put you ill at ease or catch you in a lie or anything like that.
Okay, let's move along to another one of Professor Tribe's subclaims in that tweet. He's concerned that this FBI investigation, if it's too short, it may not find that Kavanaugh has perjured himself. And so you've seen a lot of liberals saying that, you know, he lied in the hearing. And there's sort of two standards here, right? There's one is, you know, was Kavanaugh forthcoming and truthful to the committee in a colloquial sense and in a sense that we might care about when we're putting someone on the Supreme Court? And then there's another sense, which is the sense that Tribe is raising here, that Kavanaugh actually committed a crime by not just giving an answer that was misleading, but by committing the crime of perjury. And I guess when you look at Kavanaugh's testimony, do you see good candidates for statements of his that could be the crime of perjury?
Candidates, maybe a few, but not nearly as many as people are suggesting. Josh, I was looking at my notes and we saw that we talked about this subject what seems like a billion news cycles ago, but it's really only 3 or 4 weeks when people were claiming that Kavanaugh had perjured himself in connection with some things about what he did when he was in the White House in the Bush administration. What you have to remember is that perjury is pretty narrow. A statement that is misleading, that is evasive, that doesn't answer the question is not perjury. It's only perjury when you deliberately and knowingly and directly lie. So a lot of the things that people are upset about in Kavanaugh's testimony, I think, are better characterized as evasive or combative or maybe misleading. So just as one example, when he's being asked very directly, you know, are you this Bart O'Kavanaugh character in Mark Judge's book of youthful dissipation? He says you'd have to ask him that. Now, even if he knows perfectly well that that is him, and I think he does, that answer is evasive and non-responsive. It's not perjured. There may be some other things that he answered more directly that could hypothetically be perjury, like when he says that, you know, the devil's triangle is a drinking game as opposed to a sex act. I think it would be extraordinarily difficult to prove that that's perjury in a court of law. But again, we come back to the idea that this is a political process and a political decision. And the bottom line is that if you convince enough senators that he was being dishonest and not forthcoming and evasive, that's a perfectly legitimate reason for people to vote against him.
Yeah, I think I keep coming back to the line of questioning about him describing himself as a Renata alumnus or a Renata alumnius because he misspelled alumnus in the yearbook quote. And this seems like an obvious reference to claiming that he had engaged in some sort of sex act with this woman, Renata, who was a student at another high school. Many of his football teammates made similar references. And when he was asked about this, he basically said it was just an innocent reference to having attended some sort of formal event with her and there was no sexual connotation. And this is an answer that is like obviously bullshit and feels like he's insulting our intelligence. But again, I feel like if you were trying to make a perjury claim about it, it's really a claim about his state of mind. It feels like it would be essentially impossible to prove that he was intending to be, you know, this young little shit, even though that seems like obviously the case.
I concur with you completely. I agree that it is just facially entirely unbelievable and I don't care about you enough that I'm going to give you this completely contemptuous answer that no one would believe type of move, which is consistent with his general combative approach to the questioning. But I also agree that I think that would be incredibly difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
a lot of this conversation feels extremely similar to the conversation around Bill Clinton's impeachment, which, again, if you'll recall, went back to a deposition and grand jury testimony that Clinton gave as part of an investigation that began with claims that he'd sexually harassed Paula Jones and then sort of, you know, meandered and morphed into questions about the affair that he had with Monica Lewinsky when Monica Lewinsky worked in the White House. And the implicit Democratic position, both about the legal claims and about the political claims about whether it mattered if the president was being dishonest, was that basically it didn't matter really whether Bill Clinton's answers were truthful because it was such bullshit that he was even being asked the questions in the first place. And I think you're starting to sort of hear that as an undercurrent with the answers that Brett Kavanaugh is giving, that if he's dissembling about his high school yearbook, the idea is it's so ridiculous that he's being asked to justify what's in his high school yearbook quote, and therefore if he lies about it, it doesn't matter.
I think you're exactly right, although I'm going to challenge you a little bit on the idea that it meandered back in 1998 to questions about Monica Lewinsky. This was a situation where Paula Jones asserted that Bill Clinton, as you know, her senior supervisor as the governor, propositioned her and sexually harassed her. And the question of whether or not he had sexual relationships with other underlings in the course of his career was fair game. And almost any judge would allow those questions in a sexual harassment case. Clinton lied about that. Or if you take his interpretation, he had a very esoteric view of the definition of what sexual relations are. And as you said, the general argument in his favor was it was ridiculous that this ever should have been asked. And I would say that is not an argument these days that you would get very much if people were asking piercing questions about sexual conduct in the workplace in a sexual harassment suit. Similarly here, people are saying, well, it doesn't really matter whether or not he's combative or evasive or even lying because it's ridiculous they're asking these questions. Well, this is the way the legal system works. Sometimes in order to build a case, you wind up in what seems like a collateral area but is actually relevant to credibility or to pattern. And here the idea is that Kavanaugh, to a large extent, walked himself into these questions by responding to claims of sexual misconduct by sort of giving himself a choir boy halo and trying to portray himself as someone who is above reproach in high school. And, you know, once you start using that approach, you open yourself up to questions. Well, if that's the way you really are, let's talk about how you portrayed yourself then. So the notion that it's okay to lie about things when, especially under oath, when they're irrelevant questions, in your view, is fairly poisonous simply because you're always going to think that the questions about you are irrelevant. I've never had a client who didn't think that some of the questions about them were irrelevant and abusive, and they were almost always relevant.
At the beginning of Kavanaugh's testimony on Thursday, he opened by saying that this had been basically a smear campaign against him, engineered by Democrats seeking revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and he said what goes around comes around. What do you make of such an openly partisan statement from him? How does that affect how litigants, for example, will view cases before the Supreme Court when they've heard? I mean, obviously, Supreme Court nominations are always political, but I feel like they're not usually quite that political.
I found it completely disqualifying, but there's a lot of controversy on that, and it seems to break down, regrettably, largely along ideological lines. A lot of people are saying, look, if you were accused of all these terrible, terrible things that you didn't do, and I think it's fairly clear that even if there's core of truth to any of this, perhaps in Dr. Ford's testimony, there's also a lot of chaff out there and a lot of bizarre and irresponsible speculation about Kavanaugh. People say if you were accused of all these terrible things, you might lose your temper. You might come out very stridently. That might be true, but you know, we're not appointing somebody to a local library board. We're appointing someone to the Supreme Court of the United States, where they're expected to have almost superhuman detachment and to make decisions the way he's often said judges are supposed to do, based on the law and based on a complex, neutral interpretation of it, not based on your gut. And to me, lashing out like that in that circumstance demonstrated such a lack of control that, you know, unfortunately, hey, I understand why you feel that way, but can't have you making these big calls if you're going to go on about a Clinton conspiracy.
There is one more element of the Lawrence Tribe tweet for us to talk about, and that is Tribe's allegation that once on the court, Kavanaugh could shield the president from subpoena or indictment. And that's why the president is so concerned about protecting him so he can get on the court. Ken and I will talk about that after a short break, and we'll also talk about emoluments. This is All the President's Lawyers. We're back. So here's something I keep hearing from liberals. It's not just Lawrence Tribe. And it's this concern that Trump wants Kavanaugh on the court because Kavanaugh has legal views that are likely to shield the president from various aspects of criminal liability. And those concerns go into two sub-buckets. One is concerned about Kavanaugh's views on whether a president can be subpoenaed or indicted. And the other is concern about his potential views on this issue of whether states can try crimes that have already been disposed of at the federal level. There's been this idea that if Trump pardons himself or pardons associates of himself, often state prosecutors will be able to prosecute closely related crimes to the federal crimes that have been pardoned. That could be undermined if there's a change to this doctrine called dual sovereignty. So what exactly is the concern that Kavanaugh or, you know, Kavanaugh together with other justices on the Supreme Court, what they might do that would protect the president?
This does fall into a few boxes. Let me take the second one you mentioned first. Dual sovereignty is the idea that different sovereigns, like the federal government and a state, can prosecute somebody for the same thing without it being double jeopardy because they're different sovereigns with different interests being vindicated. So, for instance, we saw that in the case of the police officers who beat Rodney King back in 1991. We saw first them acquitted in state court in California and then prosecuted for civil rights violations in federal court and some of them convicted. That dual sovereignty doctrine has always been somewhat controversial. And the controversy doesn't break down exactly along ideological lines. So the idea that conservatives are more likely to be opposed and liberals for it is not true. The fear I think some people have is that there's a case before the Supreme Court coming up this term that has an opportunity to revisit the dual sovereignty doctrine. Senator Orrin Hatch has filed a brief in there, a friend of the court brief, arguing basically that so much criminal law now is federal that it just doesn't work. It allows too many dual prosecutions. And people are thinking, well, if Kavanaugh gets on the court and Kavanaugh is the deciding vote to dump this doctrine, then Trump could pardon somebody, say Manafort, for all his federal crimes, and that would preclude any state prosecution of him. Because remember, we've been talking for weeks and weeks about the prospect that if Trump pardons people, those people might still be prosecuted for state crimes. I don't think it's a good theory, and here's why. First of all, again, it doesn't break down along ideological lines cleanly. Second of all, it doesn't break down easily where if you pardon someone for a federal crime, that precludes all state prosecutions. It only precludes state prosecutions for the pretty much the exact same thing. So
I'm sorry, when you say the same thing, it's prosecutions for the same act, right? Because the cops in the Rodney King case were charged with different crimes at the state and federal level. It was a civil rights violation at the federal level versus, what was it, assault at the state level. But because it's the same underlying act, that would be implicated here by the dual sovereign if you didn't have the dual sovereignty doctrine?
Well, it's a I think, needlessly complex area of law with a bunch of different tests. But one of the tests is that it's not double jeopardy if the crimes being prosecuted have different elements, different requirements. So if the state were to prosecute something that requires them to prove additional things that didn't have to be proven in the federal case, then arguably that would not be double jeopardy, and so the pardon would not preclude it. So the bottom line is this theory about how Trump is desperate to get Kavanaugh on the court so that he can then pardon people willy-nilly and stop all prosecutions has a way oversimplified view of the way double jeopardy works and state versus federal prosecution works, not to mention the breakdown of which judges are for and against the doctrine.
So to take a concrete example here, you have Michael Cohen, who has pleaded guilty to making an excessive campaign contribution at the federal level. Some of the state crimes that have been sniffed around for Cohen and some of his people he worked with at the Trump Organization and other places are things like falsification of business records or evasion of state income taxes. Those would seem like they would have separate elements conceivably than the federal crimes that have been charged or could be charged against these people.
Exactly. So even under the most expansive view where Kavanaugh gets on the court, votes to strike down the dual sovereignty doctrine, Trump pardons Cohen, then there's still a whole wide range of things Cohen could be prosecuted for on the state side, for which double jeopardy would not apply because they are different crimes involving different transactions and different elements. All these theories rely on very elaborate legal strategic thinking on the part of the Trump administration. And I frankly have not seen evidence that that's the way the Trump administration thinks.
Do we have a reason to think that we even have any idea what Brett Kavanaugh thinks about dual sovereignty? Everyone's been focusing on the fact that Orrin Hatch filed this brief taking a stance on this issue, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's Kavanaugh's position or the position of any of the other conservative justices on the court.
Josh, I haven't seen anything suggesting which way he'd break on that. And some judges seem to vote on a narrow construction of the double jeopardy clause approach. Some judges seem to vote from a sort of due process sensibility that this feels fundamentally unfair. Some judges seem to take what Orrin Hatch is arguing, that this is about a restriction of federal power. There are a lot of different ways that you can skin this cat, and it's not clear to me which way it'll come out.
So then let's talk about the other sub-bucket of ways that Justice Kavanaugh, together with other justices on the Supreme Court, could theoretically help shield the president from some of his legal risks. And this has to do with whether the president can be forced to respond in various ways to legal actions while he's sitting as president. Can he be indicted? Can he be subpoenaed? Those sorts of things. This was the issue in Clinton versus Jones, and it was the issue before that in Nixon versus the United States, two very key Supreme Court decisions on this issue, both decisions that went in the direction that the president could be held to account. In Clinton's case, could be forced to give that grand jury testimony. In Nixon v. U.S., could be forced to hand over tape recordings, right? That was the issue there?
Yes, exactly. And again, Kavanaugh is only one guy, and I don't think there's any indication that there's a sentiment on the court with four other people standing around waiting to overturn the Clinton and Nixon precedent.
In fact, there's an indication in the other direction. Clinton v. Jones, all nine judges were on the same side of that decision, including Clarence Thomas and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, who still sit on the court today. So they're
exactly
already on record on that side. Kavanaugh did write a Law Journal article sort of taking the opposite position that a lot of people on the court have taken, although it's important to note his journal article put out a policy prescription. He said that Congress should make laws that would protect president from that would protect a president from these sorts of things. He did not take a judicial position, although people's judicial views often end up conveniently aligning with their policy views.
That's true. And again, Josh, I think I recall us talking about this exact article a billion news cycles ago. So Kavanaugh's note could be interpreted to suggest that he thinks that the president being subpoenaed is constitutionally permitted because otherwise there would be no need for an act of Congress. Or he might find his way to saying that it's not. But at any rate, he's only one guy, and there's no indication that a majority of the court is ready to overturn what seems to be fairly settled precedent. You know, the one that's still up for grabs is arguably whether a sitting president can be indicted. That has not been ruled upon. But even the Justice Department seems to take the position that a sitting president cannot be. That's been the internal policy of the Justice Department since the 70s. Even if Kavanaugh believes that a president can't be indicted while sitting, that is not an outlier of a view. It's not one where the President Trump has to reach for someone extreme or unusual to agree with him on that.
Can we talk about emoluments?
If we must.
Emoluments, this is a concept in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 9 says, quote, "No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state." So there's that rule. This is not something there's been a lot of litigation over the last 200 plus years. But now Trump is being sued by members of Congress on the grounds that he has accepted emoluments in the form of foreign government payments to his hotels and that he did so without approval from Congress. A federal court has had to rule on whether those members of Congress even had standing to bring this suit, and it found that they do have standing. How was that determined?
Well, again, Josh, this is turning into like a Clips episode because I remember us talking about this when all these emolument suits were being brought months ago. So this particular suit is brought by a bunch of members of Congress, and their argument is that President Trump is engaged still in all of these Trump empire business activities with foreign governments. They're able to rent blocks of rooms in his hotel, grant trademarks to him in China, do all these things that amount potentially to payments or gifts to him. And he hasn't gotten Congress's consent for these gifts, as the Emoluments Clause seems to require. So the only thing that's been going on in the cases so far has not really been about the merits, not really been about ultimately whether or not this is happening or whether it is illegal. It's been on the somewhat more dry issue of standing, whether or not these members of Congress have the right to bring the lawsuit. Standing is a concept that comes from Article 3 of the Constitution, and it's basically a limit on federal court power. Federal courts can only handle cases or controversies. And what the courts have decided that means is that real disputes not made up among people who are allowed to come into court to take these positions. The idea behind the standing limitation is that if you let just anyone wander into court and tee up any issue, then the federal courts can wind up running society, making every single decision. So there has to be someone who has the right to push this issue, and there has to be a live controversy. So here Trump has been saying, well, yeah, there's this clause in the Constitution, but no one really has the right to sue under it, and there's no articulable harm to anyone if my business enterprises are doing this.
Right. So that's the key thing for standing, right? When you say the articulable harm, someone has to show that they're really hurt by this thing that is happening, and that's why they personally get to bring the suit.
Well, exactly. There's a few requirements to standing. It requires that someone has injury in fact, that they've actually been injured, that there's a connection between the wrongdoing and the injury, and that it's something that the court can possibly remedy. So those are the basic elements of it. So Trump's been arguing that there's no injury and no connection and that Congress isn't actually injured. What the court wound up doing in this opinion, this district court judge, is saying that there was an actual injury to Congress in that the Constitution specifically contemplates that it's Congress's role to vote to approve or not approve gifts to the president or to other United States officers, and that what Trump was doing by accepting these gifts might be, in effect, completely nullifying their right and ability to vote. Courts in the past have said basically that Congress has limited ability to sue for the president doing things like this because usually the remedy is a vote. The remedy is political. But the theory here is that when the Constitution calls for a vote, but the president is conducting himself in a way that no vote is possible, then that deprives Congress of a right, and that's redressable in court. It's a fairly aggressive and controversial conclusion, but it's certainly one that points to this case continuing for some time and likely getting immediately appealed to a higher court.
So to the extent the merits are ever actually reached here, I assume one of the key questions is going to be, are these payments really emoluments? So if an emolument is a gift or a present, the president's lawyer at a news conference before his inauguration said paying for a hotel room is not a gift or a present. And that sounds fairly reasonable to me so long as the room is sold at a fair market value. So is the court going to have to inquire into basically, is the president just receiving fair payments in the ordinary course of business, or is he receiving excessive payments that cannot be explained from the value of the services or goods that he's providing and that therefore it is a gift?
Well, it's not clear because there's almost no emolument case law. There are no emolument lawyers wandering around there, thank God. It's hardly ever litigated, and these are questions that have not been solidly answered. I think the president presents one of the more difficult, extreme cases of this type of analysis because he has so many business interests in so many places, and it would be so easy to, in effect, gift him by doing things. There have been allegations that trademarks granted in China were granted more swiftly and more easily than otherwise might be the case. And certainly, foreign countries can have enormous economic impact by saying, we're going to hold our convention at your hotel rather than this other hotel. They might be doing it at the same rate, but in a competitive market, the decision to do business with one person rather than another can have great economic impact.
If the courts were to find that the president had received emoluments, what would the remedy be?
Your guess is as good as mine. I think they are making this up as they go along. And really one thing that has not yet been reached is the political question doctrine. So there's a doctrine that says that certain decisions are so restricted by the Constitution to the authority of a particular branch that courts can't get involved. So one of the arguments that I anticipate the president's lawyers making is that the Constitution makes this a fight between Congress and the president, and the courts shouldn't get involved. It's the Congress that gets to say yes or no, and it's up to them politically to handle this, is likely the argument the president's lawyers are going to make, because it's not clear what the remedy would be. I mean, does he have to disgorge all the money back to the countries? Does he get an order telling him not to do that anymore? We're on a blank slate here for the most part.
Well, I think it's very exciting that as this case develops, this is an issue that we will get to revisit again and again, Ken. And maybe in the end of this, you will be an emoluments lawyer, and then there will be one running around to food trucks in L.A.
I deserve this, Josh. I admit it. I deserve this.
Yeah. Speaking of fair value, the New York Times reports this week the president has some experience playing games with valuations of illiquid assets to gain shady tax advantages. They're alleging that the president and his relatives have avoided hundreds of millions of dollars in estate and gift taxes. That is something we will take a look at next week. But for now, I think this is a good place to leave it. Ken White, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
We will have another Left, Right, and Center episode for you on Friday this week. Rich Lowry is on the right. Liz Brunig is on the left. We will be talking about the lightly modified NAFTA with a new unpronounceable name. Steve Kornacki of MSNBC will join us to talk about his new book, The Red and the Blue. That's about the politics of the 90s and how we've never been able to escape the 90s, as you saw on this podcast this week. And of course, there is more Kavanaugh news to discuss. To get that episode, make sure you're subscribed to Left, Right, and Center on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. And if there's something you've been wondering about the president, the porn star, and all the president's emoluments, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and on Facebook, too. This program is produced by Sarah Fay. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and I'll be back on Friday with Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.